Going back into the organic chemistry chapter, there's a little bit of terminology that I hadn't addressed yet. And one of these bits of terminology is related to the molecule benzene that I had talked about the other day. Benzene is unusual in the way that it behaves. So I probably had mentioned before that if you have a compound that has a carbon-carbon double bond or triple bond, that makes the compound more reactive than if it just has single bonds. I should say also that if you have one of the other functional groups outside of alkanes, so something that's got an oxygen or a nitrogen in it, often that makes the molecule a lot more reactive than if you just have carbon-carbon single bonds. So if you look at the structure for benzene, the way that we write it, you might think that benzene should be relatively reactive because it has several carbon-carbon double bonds in it. At least that's the way that it appears. But you might remember me talking in lecture on Tuesday about the structure of benzene being unusual in that electrons end up being shared all the way around the molecule. And that's not something we can represent in a Lewis structure or in one of these line structures. So in other words, the way that we write the structure, we're somewhat limited. It doesn't really reflect the way that the molecule behaves. So benzene and other benzene-related compounds don't have the same reactivity that you would expect in something that has a double bond. But they do have their own variety of chemistry that these kinds of compounds can undergo. And there's a lot of derivatives of benzene, a lot of things that you can create from benzene that are very commercially important molecules. So the general term for something that contains benzene itself or some derivative of benzene, that's known as aromatic. Which it might sound like that means that they have an odor to them, and quite a number of benzene-related compounds do have an odor or fragrance that goes along with them. The term aromatic may derive from that, but it has a more specific meaning that's related to the reactivity of these kinds of compounds. So for our purposes, the definition of aromatic is a substance that contains benzene or a related structure as part of its chemical formula. And aromatic compounds are usually distinguished from the rest of the compounds by the term aliphatic. So aliphatic is a term coming from the word for fat or oil, and so that refers to a substance which contains little or no carbon-carbon double or triple bonds. The best way to think of it is that it's not aromatic. Now, there's a term that I might have used the other day or might have used just a little bit earlier that the textbook points out, and that's the term substituent. I think I might have defined it, but it is related to the word substitute. So a substituent is a small group of atoms that forms a part of a larger molecular structure. So there's some examples of substituted benzenes that are given in a portion of your chapter. And these are not structures you need to memorize. I just wanted to show them to be able to have a brief discussion. So one of them is this structure, which has two substituents on the benzene ring. Which I'm accidentally drawing backwards. One second. So the two groups that are coming off the benzene ring itself, we can refer to those as substituents. Can anybody identify from the line structure versions of these of the structure what the functional groups are on this molecule? And these are not ones that were on the quiz. So if you haven't had a chance to look past the quiz material, you might not be able to get these. So the top one, that's a COOH group, and that's a carboxylic acid. That's the same group that you would have in acetic acid, which is what you find in vinegar. The bottom group has a COO, but it doesn't have a hydrogen on the other side. It's got a carbon on it. And so that's an ester group. This is a combination of carboxylic acid and an ester. This particular compound, just to name it, is acetyl salicylic acid, which, if you never heard that name before, you might have heard of aspirin, which is the common name for the compound. So it's an aromatic compound because it's got a benzene ring in it, and it's got two different substituents, one of which is a carboxylic acid, one of which is an ester. So I just wanted to present that as an example to be able to talk a little bit about terminology. Now, benzene is a cyclic compound, but there are other simpler cyclic compounds that are not benzene. So you might know the functional group alkane. That's something that has just carbon-carbon single bonds in it. But there are what are known as cycloalkanes, which are alkanes that have some portion of the structure which is cyclic. So, for example, if we take out the double bonds that you find in benzene and you make it all single bonds, that means it's an alkane. This particular alkane I drew is known as cyclohexane. So the ane ending is what indicates that it's an alkane, something with just single bonds. Hex is the prefix meaning that it's got six carbons in it. And then cyclo is another prefix to show that it's a cyclic compound versus regular old hexane, which is a linear compound. So we had skipped over the cyclic compounds the other day. There's one other specific cyclic compound that's mentioned in your text that I wanted to bring up because later on we're going to return back to a chapter on polymers. And this is the molecule ethylene oxide. The reason it's important is it's a starting material for what are known as polyethylene oxides, a type of polymer material. So this is a very widely commercially used molecule that at the moment you don't need to memorize its structure, but like I said, it's going to come up again in a later chapter. So it's not an alkane, Actually, can you identify what functional group that would be? Well, it's an oxygen that's got two carbons attached to it, which makes it an ether. But this is a special kind of ether. Which is known as an epoxide. If you've ever heard of epoxide resins before, well, this is an example of what an epoxide is. And in an epoxide resin, that's a reaction that causes a polymer to form, in that case, to form a type of glue. So that's one of the reasons this molecule is going to show up again in our polymer chapter. Now, we've covered most of the important terminology for the rest of the chapter, but there's a couple of functional groups that we haven't yet tackled. So I wanted to mention those quickly. One is the amine group. So if we have a carbon-based compound that has an NH2 group, then that kind of molecule is called an amine. And the group itself, the NH2, is called an amino group. Amines are very often stinky compounds. For example, the smell of fish that is not exactly fresh, you probably have experienced that odor before. Those kinds of smells are often due to amines. Amines don't always have that smell to them, and there are some biologically quite important amines. Your text even mentions this one. Which is amphetamine, which is an aromatic compound because it's got a benzene ring, and then it's got the amino group, which is what makes it an amine. Of course, that amino group is the same term, amino, as what shows up in an amino acid. So an amino acid is not a functional group. It's actually a combination of two different functional groups. And this is the simplest amino acid, which, okay, let me explain this. The reason I've written H2N instead of NH2, it's just a convention that we tend to follow because the nitrogen is the thing connected to carbon. So sometimes if you want to avoid the letters themselves running into the structure, you'll write the letters in a backwards order, just as a matter of displaying the text itself. So H2N or NH2, they both mean the same thing. So an amino acid has both an amino group and a carboxylic acid group in it. And this specific molecule is the molecule glycine, which is the simplest of the amino acids. Oh, yes, question.
Sorry, yeah. They have to have some kind of carbon group between the two, right? They can't just be attached to each other for it still to be an amino and a carboxylic acid.
That's right. If you had an amino group directly attached to a carboxylic acid group, that's... oh, dear, I just blanked on the name of it. Hold on. Carbamate. It's a different type of functional group. So no, there is a carbon in between. And in fact, for the amino acids that are the majority of what makes up proteins, because that's what I was going to get to, a protein is a structure that contains one amino acid linked to the next, linked to the next, linked to the next. And in most proteins, the type of amino acids that are present are ones that have just a single carbon that's in between the amino group and the acid group. They're what are known as alpha amino acids. In general, the different amino acids have one other substituent that's attached at that same carbon. So I know that on Tuesday I showed us tryptophan, which is another amino acid. It's got the same structure to it, but it's got some other group that's attached at that same carbon that's neighboring the carboxylic acid. Now, I mentioned just a moment ago that amino acids link together to make proteins. And so one of the last functional groups that I wanted to show you is the amide. So an amide is a relative of a carboxylic acid. You might remember that an ester is another relative of a carboxylic acid, where on the acid oxygen, instead of a hydrogen like what we have on the carboxylic acid, we have a carbon group. That's what makes it an ester. Well, instead of an oxygen, if you have a nitrogen group attached, that's what makes it an amide. And then the amide might have hydrogens on that nitrogen. It might have carbons on that nitrogen, either one. And just to show you an example, if I took two molecules of glycine and hooked them together, then the connection between the two of them, that's the amide linkage. In biological terms, that's sometimes referred to as a peptide bond. So if you've ever heard that phrase before, it's referring to exactly the same functional group. It's just, like I said, from a biological perspective instead of a organic chemistry perspective. So that rounds up the chapter on organic chemistry. So what we're going to do now is we're going to jump forward into one section from chapter 14. The chapter is about water, and it's mainly environmentally related, which it's not that it's not interesting. I just want to make sure that we get through everything that's on the syllabus that we're supposed to cover. And then if we get a chance at the end of the quarter, if we wanted to revisit this chapter, if the class has any interest in the topic, we can come back and talk about some of the other sections later. But water is really unusual stuff. As I've probably talked about before when we talked about intermolecular forces. And there's some specific properties of water that are mentioned in chapter 14 that are the ones I wanted to talk about. First off, and I think this is one that's come up in class before, water is very unusual in that it's one of the few substances on the planet that expands when it freezes instead of shrinks. Most substances, when you cool them off, you might remember that temperature is related to motion of molecules inside of a sample. And so if you're going to a lower and lower temperature, that means that the molecules are moving more slowly. And usually that means that they're going to come closer together. So most liquids will contract as they turn into solids because their molecules are being pulled more closely together. But water is unusual because it's got such polarity to it, despite the fact that it's a tiny molecule. And it's that combination of being extremely polar and small that leads to its unusual behavior. And so what happens when water freezes is it forms these kinds of hexagonal structures. In other words, it forms types of hexagons. Which, let's see if your instructor can draw a hexagon. There we go. So the reason it forms these hexagon-type structures is hydrogen bonding. I know hydrogen bonding is not something we talked an awful lot about, but it's a strong form of dipole-dipole attraction. And remember that water, this is the one molecule that I've talked about over and over again, having partial positive and partial negative charges. So the hydrogens in water are partially positive, the oxygens are partially negative. So as water molecules come close to each other, they're very attracted to each other. But in their liquid form, there's enough energy there for water to overcome those attractions, so the molecules slip by each other. But when you freeze water, those attractions take over, and in fact, they pull the molecules of water apart, which creates a space in between the different water molecules. If you're creating space, that means that it takes up more volume, which means it's less dense. And less dense substances float on top of more dense substances. So that's what leads to water being very unusual in that ice floats. I probably already commented that in terms of biology, if ice sank instead of floated, it would mean that anywhere where water freezes, you probably wouldn't end up having any kind of sea life in it. Because anything that exists under the surface of the water, ice would sink, it would freeze at the bottom, and that frozen water would build up to the top, meaning the entire body of water would end up freezing eventually. But what happens instead is the ice freezes and floats, which acts as a kind of insulating layer for the water that's below it. So you can still have sea life that can exist even if a lake's frozen over, because all the ice is going to be on top, which is unlike most substances on the planet. So let me write some of what I've just said out, which is, I'll start with exactly what I just said. Water is very unusual. Because its liquid phase, its liquid form, is more dense than the solid form. Which is reversed from most substances. As I said, when water freezes, the strong attractive forces between water molecules pull the molecules apart. Forming spaces between the molecules. This causes the solid to take up more room than the liquid. Which means more volume than the liquid. So ice is less dense than water. Which is why ice floats. Now, one more property of water that's unusual is that it has what is known as a high specific heat. And let me explain what specific heat is. I'll just give you the definition. The specific heat is the amount of energy it takes to raise the temperature of 1 gram of a pure substance by 1 degree Celsius. And imagine this situation. Let's say that you were cooking and you had a wooden spoon that you put down on the stove versus a metal pan, and you left both of them on the stove for the same amount of time. Which object is probably going to get hot faster? maybe being college students, you don't all do a lot of cooking. But if you did, you might have the practical sense that wood is not going to get as hot as fast. Metals tend to get hotter faster. And that's due to the structure of what a metal is versus the wood. Metals are very easily able to conduct heat, and it doesn't take much heat in order to change the temperature of a metal, versus something like wood, which is more of an insulator, and it does take more energy to get a piece of wood up to the same temperature as a piece of metal. And so that concept that the same amount of stuff takes a different amount of heat to change the temperature, that's known as specific heat. And water, because of its unusual nature, because it's got these high intermolecular forces, ends up having a very high specific heat. That means that water is able to hold on to a lot of heat, which has effects on weather systems and the atmosphere. Because imagine you have a large body of water like an ocean that's got a certain temperature to it. For that temperature to change by much means there's large quantities of heat that have to be absorbed or released. So water acts sort of like an energy store for the planet in that sense. So that's one of the unusual properties of water. And we're actually going to talk more about specific heat next time in lecture, because along with this section in chapter 14 that we're covering, I'd like to move on to subsections in chapter 15 that deal with what is known as thermodynamics, which is has to do with the ways that energy are absorbed or released during a chemical reaction. And specific heat is a concept that's actually associated with thermodynamics. So Thursday, I want to talk a little bit more about water and then move right into that next chapter dealing with thermodynamics.